This is a coastal story. Written and presented by Charlie Connolly. It was in the aftermath of the First World War that a new generation of independent women began to set their sights on the English Channel. With men away at the front, women had effectively kept the country running during the war, working in factories and workshops, keeping up the production of munitions and wider heavy industry. The success of these suffragette campaigns demonstrated the new determination of women to push back fiercely against the male-dominated world. And what greater demonstration of equality could there be than swimming the Channel? The first attempt by a woman had been as long ago as 1900, when Baroness Walpurga von Isachescu of Vienna showed up in Calais with a bathing costume and an ambition. As decorum dictated, she entered the Channel from a bathing machine outside the Calais Casino at 7:30 in the morning on the 21st of September, after breakfasting on 2 eggs and a glass of port. A couple of miles out into the Channel, the wind blew up and impeded her progress, carrying her to the east. But when the tide turned in the early afternoon, she was carried back towards Dover. By 5:30, however, the temperature had dropped, and the Baroness had started to struggle. It took some persuasion, but eventually she agreed on her pilot's advice to abandon her attempt. She'd been in the water for 10 hours and swum more than 20 miles. The Channel was almost exclusively a male preserve until after the First World War. Once the Channel had been cleared of mines, there began first a trickle and then a flood of women attempting the crossing. It wouldn't be long before one of them succeeded either. Manhattan-born Gertrude Ederle was already a swimming superstar when she arrived in France in 1925 for her first attempt. Barely 18 and the daughter of a German butcher, her incredible speed through the water had already earned her a number of accolades. Between 1921 and 1925, the year she turned professional, Ederle smashed 29 world swimming records, breaking 7 in one remarkable afternoon. Although she was hot favourite to win Olympic gold in the Paris Games of 1924, the combination of a knee injury and the US team having based itself a 5-hour round trip from the capital so as to keep the athletes safe from the City of Light's bohemian morality restricted her to 2 individual bronzes and 1 relay team gold. When she first arrived in Dover, she had just set a record for swimming between Manhattan's Battery Park and Sandy Hook, accomplished in a time of 7 hours and 11 minutes, a time that would remain unbeaten for 81 years. But this was merely a warm-up for an attempt to become the first woman to swim the English Channel. To help achieve this, the US Women's Swimming Association engaged as her trainer none other than the famous British swimming coach, Jabez Wolfe. More about him next week. Wolfe was bullish about Ederle's chances before she'd even arrived in the country, predicting that she would not only succeed, but shave a hefty chunk from the fastest recorded time, 14 hours and 25 minutes, by the Italian swimmer Enrico Tiraboschi 2 years earlier. Only 5 people had succeeded in swimming the Channel when Ederle arrived in France, so Wolfe's confidence either displayed carefully reasoned optimism or was expressed while he was still negotiating his fee. By early August, with Ederle's attempt just a couple of weeks away, he had changed his tune. "I think Miss Ederle is the fastest swimmer alive, but I do not expect her to succeed in swimming the Channel this time," he said of the teenager. "She refuses to train, and plays the ukulele all day. Apparently she broke her records without much training and doesn't see why she should train now. Also, she swims too fast. As it happened, Wolf's prediction was right on the money. Edeli began at Cap Guinée early on the morning of the 18th of August and made good progress until mid-afternoon when a westerly wind blew up. She began to struggle as the waves grew larger and the giant Egyptian swimmer Ishak Helmi, who'd been assisting Wolf while preparing for a channel attempt of his own, dived into the water alongside her to check on her condition. When he reported back to Wolf that the American was close to collapse, with 6 miles still to go before Dover, Wolf told him to pull her out of the water. She was barely conscious. Any longer, surmised the Channel veteran, and the American superstar would have drowned. By the time she'd returned to the US in mid-September, Edeli had decided the trainer was to blame for her failure. Wolf, she claimed, had ordered her out of the water prematurely and against her will. Wolf, unsurprisingly, wasn't taking that lying down. "Her statements are quite untrue," he thundered from his home in Brighton. "I take it her story was meant to cover her non-compliance with my prepared efforts to get her to train. It was evident to both British and French observers that her training consisted mainly of sitting about playing her ukulele. I am of the opinion that had Miss Edeli followed my instructions and not been interfered with by her American advisers, she would have succeeded in swimming the channel. I still think she is capable, as long as she is properly trained," harumphed the man employed to properly train her. "Of course I played my ukulele," responded Edeli from across the Atlantic, "but only in the evenings when my training was concluded. That was my only relaxation." The following year she was back, a little older, probably wiser, and with a new trainer, someone who had succeeded in swimming the channel, one Bill Burgess. On the 6th of August 1926, Edeli was up before dawn at the Hôtel La Sirène near Cap Guinée to demolish a bowl of cornflakes, half a fried chicken and a plate of bacon and eggs. As she threw down her knife and fork onto an empty plate, Burgess asked her how she was feeling. "Like I could lick Jack Dempsey," she replied. A little after 7 o'clock in the morning, Trudy Edeli waded into the sea and set out for Dover. Accompanied by her support boat, the Alsace, with Burgess and her parents among those on board. She covered 2 miles in her first hour, despite a brief stop for stomach cramps, and by late morning she was going well, 6.5 miles north of Cap Guinée and singing along to the gramophone records being cranked out by her mother on the Alsace. "The water is wonderful. I could stay in for a week," she chirruped. At midday she rested briefly, drank a baby's bottle filled with beef tea and ate some chicken. In the middle of the afternoon, her pace dropped. The wind rose. It began to rain, and her chirpy commentary stopped. She kept swimming, but the cheeriness had gone, along with the good weather. Edeli's team attempted to keep up her spirits with a lusty rendition of "Yes, We Have No Bananas," which must have helped. But then the tug, hired by rival newspapers to the New York Daily News, with whom Edeli had signed an exclusive agreement, turned up and proved to be a more serious danger to her success than wind and fatigue. As photographers strained for close-ups, twice the vessel veered too close to the swimmer, throwing waves that submerged her altogether. Another brisk westerly wind blew up. The Alsace skipper told Burgess and Edeli's father they were being carried too close to the notorious Goodwin Sands and would need to take a new southwesterly course to avoid them. This would add significantly to the distance Edeli needed to swim, but their current course was too dangerous. The sea rose further, substantial waves breaking over the bow, while for worryingly long periods, Edeli's bright red swimming cap kept vanishing between the steepling waves. Skipper, father and trainer pored over the charts in the wheelhouse and realised that once she made it past the South Goodwin lightship, the sea would become calmer and the tide would be in her favour. Burgess went out and gave her the news, looking down from the heaving ship at the red speck rising and falling with waves much larger and more powerful than any he'd experienced during his own channel swim. Seeing this vulnerable young woman pressing on in such dreadful conditions, Burgess was almost overcome with admiration. "God Almighty," he called to nobody in particular as he clung to the rail, the wind whipping the words from his mouth. "I never saw anyone so marvellous." But the channel wasn't done with Trudy Edderly yet. So severe had the wind been that when the skipper checked his chronometer, he found that the tide was turning almost 2 hours early. They were now a mile from the English coast, but that mile would be the toughest of them all. Edderly would need to turn away from Dover, they realised, and aim instead for St. Margaret's Bay, near the South Foreland Lighthouse. Burgess told her the news as he handed over a couple of slices of pineapple, and Edderly bore it stoically, taking a deep breath and throwing herself towards the shore. Her warhorse of a trainer was still utterly in awe. "No man or woman ever bore such a swim," he said, as he turned back to the rest of the crew. "It is past human understanding." Half a mile from the shore, at about 7:45 in the evening, Edderly began for the first time to doubt if she could make it. Then she looked up and saw a crowd of people gathering on the shore outside the Zetland Arms in Kingsdown, just south of Deal. They were lighting flares on the beach to help guide her home. Burgess and her father climbed into a rowing boat and accompanied her over the final few hundred yards, Burgess counting them down as they went, Edderly's red cap still disappearing from view beneath the foam for seconds at a time, until eventually her feet touched shingle. After 14.5 hours in the water, a full 2 hours faster than anyone ever before, she felt suddenly heavy as she stumbled through the surf and was engulfed by the cheering crowd. Her father retrieved the bewildered, exhausted swimmer from the well-wishers, returned her to the Alsace and made the short journey to Dover, where a comfortable bed awaited her in the Grand Hotel. An estimated 2 million people lined the streets of Manhattan on her return, where she was granted a ticker tape parade along Fifth Avenue. The city's official greeter, Grover A. Whelan, said that of all the greats he'd welcomed and escorted on their parades, none had made the impact Trudy Edderly did. President Calvin Coolidge described her as America's best girl. With her bobbed hair and sparky personality, she had proved that she could not only match men, but outperform them at one of the world's great tests of physical endurance. She became a symbol of the modern, liberated American woman. But she found fame hard to handle, and having been bundled onto a vaudeville tour and then into a Hollywood film of her story, not to mention the hundreds of marriage proposals she received, everything finally got too much. "I got the shakes," she told an interviewer years later. "I was just a bundle of nerves. I quit the tour, and by the time I did, I was almost completely deaf." Her hearing had been damaged by a bout of measles as a toddler, a condition exacerbated by her swimming and worsened considerably by the battering she'd taken in the channel. The added stress of relentless adulation had only made the condition worse until she could hear practically nothing. She became engaged in 1929, but when she told her suitor he might find it difficult having a wife who couldn't hear, he conceded she had a point and promptly vanished. In 1933, Edderly slipped on some broken tiles in the stairwell of the building where she lived and injured her back so badly it was feared she would never walk again, let alone swim. Bedbound for 4 years, She managed to recover enough to make a brief appearance at a 1939 aquatic circus held as part of the New York World's Fair, and during the war worked testing aircraft instruments at LaGuardia Airport. She spent many years teaching deaf children to swim and lived to the age of 98, making it into the new millennium, before dying in 2003. "I've no complaints," she said in an interview towards the end of her life. "I am comfortable and satisfied. I'm not a person who reaches for the moon, as long as I have the stars." That was A Coastal Story, and I'm Charlie Connolly. And that was actually an extract from my book, The Channel, published by Orion and out in paperback on the 25th of June. If you want to pre-order it, that will be a big help. If you order it before it comes out, then the shops get quite excited because they think it's going to be really popular. And it is going to be really popular, because who wouldn't want to read a book full of stories about the English Channel? You can find us on Twitter at Podcast Coastal and on Facebook by searching for Coastal Stories Podcast. The book's out in paperback, priced $9.99 from all good bookshops, a few dodgy ones, some that are quite selective and some that'll take any old toot. I'll see you next week with the incredible story of Jabez Wolfe, the man who tried and failed to swim the channel 22 times.